Welcome to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People. This show can be heard on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network every Friday at 1 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to dreamvision7radio.com, click Listen Live, and enjoy the show.
Hello, this is Dr. Emmett Miller. Welcome back to Conversations with Extraordinary People. Here, our goals are to look beyond the superficial, to encounter the essence of the human experience, to explore new and creative ways of meeting life's obstacles, challenges, and opportunities successfully. Our purpose is to discover new and powerful ways of healing, balancing, and optimizing the function of mind, body, emotion, behavior, and spirit. At this time in history, we desperately need to heal and transform at both the individual and the collective level. In each episode, we bring you intelligent conversations with the movers and shapers who have created the new medicine and other holistic approaches to individual and collective healing, and those who are still contributing wisdom and practical guidance. Along with this, you will receive practical tools and experiential guided imagery meditation to help us integrate the wisdom our guest brings us. So, once again, it's time to relax, focus your mind, and open your heart to the power within. Welcome to another paradigm-shattering conversation. Dr. Sunil Pai is a board-certified physician, an MD in holistic integrative medicine. He did a residency in family medicine at the University of New Mexico and then became a fellow of the program in integrative medicine at the University of Arizona, class 2002, directed by Andrew Weil. He is certified by Dr. Deepak Chopra as a primordial sound meditation instructor and a creating health lifestyle instructor. And much more indeed. I ran into Dr. Pai at the Integrative Health Conference in San Diego not long ago and wandered into one of his talks where he was speaking about diet and cancer, both preventing it and helping to treat it. And I hear a lot of nonsense in this direction, but fortunately my 50 years of practice have given me a good detector, and I can detect when there's something valuable going on. And I sat for the whole talk and was absolutely captured by the good sense and the wisdom and the new information that was there. Dr. Pai is in the process of writing and may have finished by the time you hear this particular recording his book entitled An Inflammation Nation. So I hope that we'll have time to touch on both of those items today. So, Dr. Pai, welcome to Conversations with Extraordinary People.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about an inflammation nation. Give us the real skinny on that.
Well, skinny is a good word, but the book is about, it is something that in my practice for 15 years, practicing integrative medicine, it's a culmination of my experience and what I've been able to provide to my patients in terms of improving overall outcome. Mm-hmm. An inflammation nation is basically going to be a definitive 10-step guide to preventing and treating all diseases through diet, lifestyle, and the use of natural anti-inflammatories. And so I take the reader, as I do my patients, through different steps of modalities, particularly starting off with diet first. First of all, learning what inflammation is, and we can talk about that. Looking at eating more of a organic, non-GMO, anti-inflammatory, plant-based diet. We look at how do we even look at what's pro-inflammatory or what are triggers of inflammation in the person's body that's unique to them. So we talk about certain types of testing and things that can be done, very simple, easy matters. Then we talk about how do we clear the toxins, how do we clear inflammation out of the body, even emotional inflammation, for example, aside of the environmental toxins. We talk about healthy lifestyle behaviors such as avoiding smoking, avoiding taking NSAIDs, which are non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like acetaminophen and ibuprofen, and the dangers to that. And what we have in terms of using a natural anti-inflammatory, which is our flagship that I've developed called Bosmeric SR, which is one of the strongest natural anti-inflammatory dietary supplements available that has a 20-minute onset of action, 8-hour sustained release with 4 patented ingredients, which I can talk about today as well. And then we go into other things in terms of like increasing immune system functioning, and maintaining patients' healthy blood glucose level, and avoiding excess sugar and salt in their diet. And then, of course, my favorite, which is yours, is stress reduction, using, you know, meditation, yoga. And then also, lastly, we look at love, happiness, and social relationships. Mm. That's a really important part of all of it.
I really like to hear you speak about evidence-based medicine. It's people are so often very fond of saying, you know, doctors don't learn anything about nutrition in medical school. And whereas that's probably true, that doesn't mean if you're not a doctor that you automatically know everything there is to know about nutrition.
Absolutely. And one of the things that most people don't realize is that physicians now are being bombarded in their office by what we call the nutraceutical reps. So there's just as many reps now coming in selling nutrition supplements based off of them being prior pharma reps. And that's not a good way to get your education as well. They need to understand that the physician still has to educate themselves by reading and researching. And so there's a lot of misleading people even in the health industry because physicians are busy like you and I. People will come in and try to, you know, sell the latest and greatest supplement. But we have to look at what's the evidence base. And in my practice, what we do is we look at everything under the same microscope. So certain drugs, you know, are very good and certain drugs are very bad and certain supplements the same way. So I take an open mind to everything, but we have to be very skeptical on the data and who's presenting that data. So, for example, in my book, I have about 400 references, so people are going to be surprised that even certain statements that we make and certain topics and ideas that's even talking about how a food may be produced or this is how the supplement or this is the data, how what's being presented right now on the Internet, you'll see all the references because we need to know that there's a lot of data to back up those statements. So that we're not just, making fancy marketing statements as well.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, let's start. When you say in Inflammation Nation, what's inflammation?
So inflammation, you know, in short, I always tell my patients, you know, the word, start off with the root word. And inflammation, the root of the word of inflammation comes from the word flam or fire, or it equals the word itis, I-T-I-S. And so I always give the analogy in the body that the body has to have a certain amount of inflammation. Some of it's positive and some of it's negative, kind of the yin and the yang of the body. There's always a delicate balance. And if you take like a kitchen stove or a fireplace, for example, in the house, you're going to cook your food to a certain temperature. You don't want it too hot. You don't want it too cold. Same thing with the fireplace in your living room. You want the temperature to be regulated. I call it the Goldilocks rule, right? Not too hot, not too cold. Mm-hmm. And so the body has this ability to have inflammation. Now, the inflammation that I talk about is, we particularly look at, is inflammatory or immunological mechanisms, and there's thousands of these different reactions. So there's, you know, we think of inflammation only just being one aspect or one pathway, but every day we're discovering in immunology there's different pathways. So although there's, say, like a main freeway in California to go to your home, there's actually hundreds of streets and back roads that you can actually take to get there. And so inflammation, how it works is that your body needs some. So let me give you some examples of healthy inflammation. So if you have a fever, for example, say you have a little viral infection, the body's going to raise its blood temperature to actually help fight the infection. It's actually kind of raising its temperature to actually be more active in actually killing out the virus or bacteria. And that's a healthy thing. Unfortunately, sometimes we actually suppress the fever, which actually lowers the body's ability to defend what it's actually trying to do. But, for example, that fever will go down after the infection is gone. So the body's brought it back into balance. Or say you're walking or you're hiking and you step on a rock and you say, ouch, that your foot will move and that pain signal is actually an inflammatory signal. That pain is just the emotion that we kind of correlate with that feeling of that response. And obviously you'll move your foot and you keep on walking. And so the body's going to bring it back into balance. The problem is when these inflammatory triggers or mechanisms become chronic or uncontrolled. So say, let's take the kitchen again or the living room. Say you now have a kitchen fire or your living room's on fire, then there's problems. and it's harder to control. And that chronic inflammation over time, through also with lifestyle, poor dietary lifestyle factors, can trigger the onset of more chronic diseases, and including the onset of cancer. So when we look at, let me just give you an example here. When we look at, say, a knee, a normal knee, and then when we have chronic inflammation into that knee, over time we call it arthritis. We take a normal colon, and we over, you know, having a long period of time of inflammation, we call it colitis. We now understand and view heart disease as being an inflammatory disease. When the arteries get inflamed, then the cholesterol that only comes from animal protein, by the way, and if there's inflammation in the arterial walls, it has a tendency to stick, and that stickiness then ends up causing cardiovascular disease or plaque, and too much plaque then ends up causing a restriction of blood flow or leading to one to having angina or a heart attack. Same thing happens in the brain. Over decades of inflammation in the brain, we start seeing neurodegenerative changes and certain type of protein plaques like beta amyloid and tau proteins, and we'll call these plaque proteins come in when there's inflammation, and then when we diagnostically look on an MRI or CT scan, we'll say, oh, there's plaques in the brain, that patient has Alzheimer's disease, for example. So now we have about 200 different itis conditions that we have now classified in Western medicine. So I'll give you an example of a few. So red eyes, if you have allergy, we call it conjunctivitis. Runny nose, we call it rhinitis. Sinusitis. People who have gum problems, we call it gingivitis. You know, sore throat, we call it pharyngitis. And so we have esophagitis and gastritis and colitis and prostatitis and vaginitis and dermatitis and tendonitis. So as you can see, the list goes on. And most of us, over a period of time, will get a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And the challenge is that when we go see conventional medicine physician, we treat those symptoms very successfully, but we tend to forget what is causing that inflammation to begin with. So if I had red eyes, I'd go to my ophthalmologist, and they'd give me eye drops, and I get clear eyes. And if I had congestion, my dad's actually an ENT, he's a wonderful ear, nose, and throat physician for 43 years, and so he may give me a nasal spray, and man, that will clear up my nose. And when I had asthma as a kid, I'd go to a pulmonologist, and they'd give me an inhaler, and that would clear up my lungs. And when I had eczema as a child, I'd go to my dermatologist, and she would provide me a steroid cream, and that would cut down the inflammation. But as soon as I stopped taking any of these medications, then I would flare again, right? So we're really good at treating the individual symptom, but we never ask the question, well, what is causing this itis? And since we specialize in micromanaging the individual and not looking at the person as a whole, we tend to lose track of what we're actually doing, and then people end up treating the symptoms for decades, and in fact, entire lifestyle, mm-hmm. lifetimes.
Mm-hmm.
So from our standpoint, when we look at how we address inflammation, we first want to look at diet, because diet's the largest role of what we put in our body every day. And we look at all the comprehensive short-term, long-term clinical trials and prospective large epidemiological studies. They all demonstrate that a whole food plant-based diet, means a greater intake of plant-based proteins and reducing the amount of animal-based proteins, always shows a better health outcome in all categories. That means ranging from chronic pain, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, blood pressure, obesity, you name it. Every single study will show that, again, a whole food plant-based diet always has a better outcome when they reduce the amount of animal protein intake. So in our clinic, we teach that. We teach people how to slowly shift their diet to eating more plant-based. We're one of the facilities and centers in New Mexico, the only one that's been certified by the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine out of Washington, D.C. And so we actually have cooking classes and cooking programs to our patients. And eventually, by the end of the year, we're going to actually have an organic vegan restaurant in our center so that we can actually demonstrate and provide people with healthy foods. But more importantly, when we look at inflammation, it's not just telling people to eat plant-based. And this is where my practice kind of differs than most plant-based physicians is because we look at everybody being uniquely individual and their immune system response being uniquely individual themselves. And so we do a lot of testing in which we look at, out of all the foods, plants or animals or vegetables or legumes or beans or grains, for example, which ones do trigger a specific immunological response within that individual. And some responses are going to happen within an hour. We call them an IgE response. And some of them actually can happen up to a few hours, up to 4 days later. We call them IgG4 responses. And we do this testing because we want to look at, just because I tell someone, hey, eat more plants and eat less animal proteins, and someone can still have a sensitivity to soy or corn or tomatoes or even chili, for example. And we wouldn't want them to be juicing and eating tons of these foods, which may be a potential trigger to their immunological system response of causing more inflammation, which will then exacerbate any of their conditions. So we really are specific when we teach in our clients in our clinic here, is not only how to eat better, but then also specifically what are the triggers that would make and exacerbate what their conditions that come to see me for.
Hmm. Wow, sounds really fascinating.
Well, it's a great thing, because I'll just give you a couple of examples. You know, we always want to remove animal protein. So, for example, dairy. So dairy is one of the biggest things that we want to encourage all our patients to slowly get off of, because we know that the dairy protein, particularly the casein molecule, you know, and Colin Campbell and everybody's studied the China study, and we've read a lot of studies since then, but we know that the dairy protein stimulates, since 1995 in the literature and research, stimulates more insulin growth factor number one. And we know that cancer cells have 10 times more insulin receptors, and this is a promoter. So when they looked at the China study, we looked at the growth and culture, we noticed that there was an amount that they would give to an animal that already had cancer that would exponentially grow the tumor cells. And that was about 20% in the studies. We actually now know it's about 8% or more in the diet, percent of the daily calories from the dairy protein. Now, the average American is taking between 20 and 40% a day. And so what that correlates to is, right now, the average American consumed 2 pounds of dairy product per person last year. And so it's a lot. And we're eating more than any other physical country or people in terms of the whole planet. And we also see that why 1 in 2 men and 1 in 3 women now have more cancer in their lifetime here in the United States than any other country. So we have to look at our diet, you know, and even Bruce Lipton, who you've talked to, you know, we'll talk about epigenetics. These are the lifestyle factors and environmental factors and even belief systems that trigger these onset of the diseases rather than genetics only.
Mm-hmm. And much of our knowledge, and certainly the knowledge that's present in the traditional sort of medical setting, is a sort of knowledge that we had in the 60s and in the 70s. But starting in the 80s and 90s, we've begun to have, there were no studies that were being done in this area, no significant ones. And we also didn't have the equipment to actually measure the kinds of things that we're measuring now. That can really show us. So what other experiments have around the dairy protein? What else have they done
settings? So I'll just give you an example. When they fed the animal, say, a 5%, this is going back to Colin Campbell's data and other people even prior, before him and after him, but when they triggered a cancer in the animal first, right? And then we fed the animal 5% of the total daily calories of the casein molecule or casein protein or dairy protein, there would be no growth in those tumor cells or tumor nodules. But if it was increased, so the cut threshold is 8%, but in these classic studies, they just picked 5 and 20 just as arbitrary numbers. When they hit a 20%, there was an exponential growth. But interesting thing, what makes the story even really impressive about them, this is what made me become a vegan in 2009 after the China study, because it wasn't that it was just promoting it to grow. But if you took that same animal that had the growth of the tumor cell, tumor burden, and it was consuming a 20% amount, and you reduced it to 5%, then that same tumor cell nodules would decrease in size. And then they would take that animal a few weeks later and increase from 5 to 20%, and it would increase the tumor cell. So what we learned is that they were turning it on and off. It was a promoting switch. Mm-hmm. So dairy does not cause cancer. And so I want to be very clear, dairy does not cause cancer. But if there's cancer cells in the body, it's one of the strongest known carcinogens to man because it stimulates insulin growth factor. And we know that right now in a lot of cancer research and most of the kind of the integrative oncology aspects, we're looking at what are these kind of immunological markers and what are the things that we can surveillance patients that are either at higher risk or higher risk for recurrence once they've already had a cancer, and IGF-1 is one of those things. Insulin growth factor is not a bad thing. The problem is that we're not supposed to be consuming dairy in general. Remember, a calf will drink its mother's milk, which has IGF-1, and that little calf will grow to 2,500 pounds, and then it'll consume grass the rest of its life. A traditional field cow, not the factory farmed ones, unfortunately.
Right? Yeah. Right.
And same thing, most of us, hopefully, were breastfed from mom, and our mom's milk has IGF-1, and, you know, by the time we look at all cultures, Emmett, what we see is that, you know, between the age of 1 and 4, we were weaned off the breast. And usually by age of 4 in all cultures, we're weaned off the breast. And by that time, that young child is eating the adult food of the community at a time. And what we're now understanding is that even biologically, by the age of 4, most of the population on this planet loses the lactase dehydrogenase enzyme, which breaks down dairy, so we have lactose intolerance. Okay, because we're not supposed to be drinking milk after that. We've already grown to a little child. The problem is now that we're adults and we're having 2 pounds per day of the average person in the United States, you know, we're seeing this rapid production of growth, and we can see this correlation very strongly with the rise of a variety of types of cancers that we don't see in other countries that consume a far less amount.
But we were taught that milk is nature's most perfect food, and we never outgrow our need for milk.
Exactly. And in fact, you know, milk does the body good. You know,
yeah, right.
You know, those campaigns, and, you know, I grew up in, I went to public school just like everybody else, and we sang the songs, and we had the little 4-3-2-1, and, you know, the pyramid was given to us. But we now understand that when we look at nutritional science, we have to look at the science behind it. And most of this education has been formed by the lobby and those groups that support those industries, and it became more of a marketing campaign. So,
yeah.
You know, we all think that, oh, you know, dairy is good for our bone health, yet there's very little. I mean, having a serving of kale has just as much calcium than a glass of milk, without the cholesterol, without the hormones, without the antibiotics, without, you know, all these other aspects. And so we have to look at the concept of that we've been really marketed, and in physicians themselves, and, you know, when you, from our public school systems all the way into the hospitals, you know, we've been told this, and almost every patient and client can recite even the commercials or the billboards. It's
mm-hmm.
that powerful.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that there's really not much data to show that it does the body good. In
mm-hmm.
fact, there's more data to show that it doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Right. Unless you want to grow 2,500 pounds like a calf.
Right. But we see this, you know, this huge increase in obesity, and particularly since there's less breastfeeding now in the United States than most countries, we see this obesity largely in even young, very young children. And you're being in family practice. I mean, you know, I remember when I first started medical school, we really didn't see obesity. Even in 1990, you know,
mm-hmm.
when we look at the maps, there was, you know, very little obesity. And now, like, the whole country's turned to the red color on the CDC maps. And we now see children who are now being taken away from social services from families because of obesity.
Mm-hmm.
So we've really progressed to this state where we're really, we're getting lack of nutrients, but we're getting overabundance of calories and overabundance of things that are not necessarily healthy for us.
And of course, it's the prepared foods. It costs more to eat well.
Well, that's a little bit of a misnomer. So what we teach our patients is this, because that's what's been also marketed to us, right? They say, oh, well, you know, everybody has to go to the fancy Whole Foods market, for example, and, oh, it's not my town, I don't have a health food store. It's like, you know, we teach our patients even how to grow food, how to create a garden. I mean, now going back to even, you know, when you were young, and I'm growing up here in New Mexico, it is very inexpensive. It costs nothing to have beans and rice. You know, there's staples that we grew up on in many cultures that we could actually grow. I mean, getting a pound of dried beans is pennies on the dollar, right? But, you know, we've been told that we need to go to the fancy grocery store. We have here in Albuquerque, luckily for us, we have a variety of co-ops. We have all our patients sign up so they get delivery of organic local produce that trades within 4 different states. So we really try to push them to look at, like, it doesn't have to be expensive. But you're right. Eating cheap food is easy.
Mm-hmm.
And we push people economically to eat cheap food. So in New Mexico, we're the 40th poorest state in the nation. So we love fast food in New Mexico, because when the average family of 4 in New Mexico makes around $35,000 to $40,000, right, which is not much above the poverty line
mm-hmm.
in other states, a bucket of chicken for $20 goes far for a family of 4.
Mm-hmm.
But what they don't realize is they're increasing a high amount of saturated fats, high amounts of omega-6s, which are pro-inflammatory, and so we do have this, what we call this inflammation nation. We're eating 40 times the ratio of omega-6s to omega-3s than we did in 1950 now today.
Mm-hmm.
And in certain places in America, we have a 70-to-1 ratio. We call it the stroke belt. That's Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama.
Uh-huh.
I watched just recently on the Food Network, they had over the Christmas holidays a county fair, and they had this Twinkie that was stuffed with the Twix, rapid bacon, deep fried. So you can tell, like, you know, and well, that's why they have the call the stroke belt, because when people eat such of those things, those foods, they trigger more inflammation, more heart disease, etc. So we really have kind of gone to the excess, and I think convenience is not convenient. And I tell all my patients, and we teach them how to cook, we teach them how to make quick, simple meals for their family, how to prepare foods, how to shop for foods. That's one of the items and services that we offer. We go shopping with our patients.
Mm-hmm.
We take them because, again, most people have not even learned to shop. Whatever your grandmother did, your mom did, and then you teach you to go. And most people can shop almost blindfolded, and they can go to the store and pick these things out. And they've never really looked at the other aisles. They've actually never gone through and looked at how do you pick a ripe fruit, piece of fruit. You know, how do you pick a ripe type of watermelon versus a cantaloupe, how do you know about some of these things that doesn't come in a package? Some of the biggest challenges that we have with our patients that once they get a box of food delivered to their house, the first thing, especially during the first box that they all get delivered, we usually get one or two calls a week. And the calls would be like, well, what do I do with this? Because they've never seen the food in the natural state. Mm-hmm. Right? It's usually packaged, it's chopped up, it's sauteed, it's like, this is what kale looks like, this is what spinach looks like, this is charred, this is what the real food looks like. And they don't know what to do with it. So we then have to teach them those skills. But once you teach them those skills, then they have a lifetime of actually being their health advocate.
Say a little bit more about that ratio of omega-3s and 6s.
Okay, so in 1950 to 1960, and this is one of the aspects of my book when we start talking about the inflammation nation, 1950 to 1960, the average American consumed a 1-to-1 relationship, some data may say a 2-to-1 relationship of omega-6s to omega-3s. Omega-6s are pro-inflammatory, and that comes from animal protein, so beef, pork, chicken, lamb, eggs, those things. So animal proteins, remember, only come from things that have mothers or faces. That's an easy way to remember. So that's an animal protein. Anything that doesn't have a mother or a face is not an animal protein. And they used to eat this one-to-one relationship. The problem is, over time, with these highly processed fatty foods, is that we've increased that ratio. So it's about 40-to-1 now. So we're eating 40 times. So there's 40 omega-6s to one omega-3. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when we give and when you start in the last 10 years, you see this huge push for omega-3s, right? Everything's omega-3, fish oil and all these different types of oils. And the aspect is that because we're eating so much omega-6s, we're trying to balance out that ratio. So if we're eating 40-to-1, then they're trying to raise this 0 or this 1 to be back up to 40. But really how you get the full anti-inflammatory benefit is reducing the omega-6s first. Mm-hmm. That's your biggest bang for buck. And that costs nothing to not put it in the mouth.
Uh-huh. Wow. Amazing.
Now, the other places that we get omega-6s, by the way, is also the highly refined oil. So I can't forget to mention that because some people will say, well, hey, you're only picking on the animal proteins. No, the highly refined oils also is an omega-6. So we have to be careful of fried foods a lot and the heavy refined oils like corn, safflower, soybean oil, and peanut oil. So it's not actually the beans, legumes, or the vegetable itself, but when they highly process it, just like any food that's highly processed, it's basically a linoleic acid. Arachidonic acid is also coming from the animal protein. So you put that two together, it's called the arachidonic acid pathway. That's just the highway of inflammation, as we call it. So the cheeseburger french fry concept, not that that's bad or dangerous, but we're eating 40 times that amount, Emmett, now than what we did. And I'll just give you a classic example. In New Mexico, we wake up in the morning and we usually have like a breakfast burrito, okay? So it's a highly refined wheat product with a dairy product like eggs, with cheese, with beef, sausage, and ham. Okay, and chili here, okay, from New Mexico. Then at lunch, we might have a cheeseburger, which is basically the same thing. We're having highly refined bun, some kind of beef, bacon on it, cheese, and then maybe for dinner, we might have pizza, right? It's the same thing. So we're pretty much in the standard American diet. We're eating the same foods. Unlike other cultures, we're eating a variety of seasonal foods, a lot of plant-based foods. Here, we have the same foods which have no fiber, very little antioxidants, no phytonutrients. They still have protein. But the thing is, we need all four to have optimum health.
Well, just want to remind everybody, you're listening to Conversations with Extraordinary People, which comes to you as a result of the work of our fantastic team here. It is a publicly supported program, you notice, no commercials. We depend upon your support. Your purchase of our self-healing products at drmiller.com will help. Your purchasing of the books and products of our guests is also very helpful because they donate their time as well. You can also support us by telling your friends, your clients, your patients, and those on your mailing list and your Facebook list about what we have to offer. So visit our multimedia website, drmiller.com, where you will find my videos, archives of all these conversations in case you've missed any. A plethora of information on mind-body medicine, personal transformation. If you click on the word store in the menu, you will find a huge collection of my audio and video programs featuring self-applied deep relaxation and guided imagery meditations for healing your body, balancing and invigorating your emotions, overcoming bad habits, and achieving peak performance. And remember, if you sign up for our free e-newsletter and regular free guided imagery and meditation gifts, we'll give you two gifts free immediately. Thanks again to those who have supported us along the way. We appreciate it, and by all means, keep it up. You can learn more about Dr. Pai by going to the website, which is www.sanjeevani.net. That's SANJEEVANI.net. And I'm sure you'll be happy with what you find. So, Sunil, tell us now about Grain Brain.
I have a whole section in my book about that. Not to pick on anybody, everybody has their opinions of nutrition, but when we look at evidence-based issues, is there's a big misnomer right now in the United States about wheat and grains. And so there's a lot of books, Grain Brain, Wheat Belly, and there's a whole probably slew more that are on the bestseller list. And what we have to look at is two things. Number one, there is a truth in the matter that all the books are saying, which is absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. Does the average American eat too many highly refined carbohydrates, particularly wheat products? Absolutely. Is that unhealthy? Absolutely. Is a foot-long Subway sandwich that's made in a fast food restaurant not considered a nutritious food? Absolutely. Is there problems with the actual wheat product that has been glutenized and GMO'd and genetically enhanced to have more gluten? Absolutely. Is there issues with the use of not cooking it correctly, like we traditionally used to do, and not using it, the fermentation process and multiple yeast to break down the gluten, gliadin, proteins, that then when we lack that, we do have problems with intolerance? Absolutely. And finally, is there problems with the glyphosate that's added to by certain companies such as Monsanto on top of the wheat products, which now we now look at causing a lot of gut issues like leaky gut and other aspects of some of these pesticides and herbicides or things that help increase yield before they go to market that's still on the product? Absolutely. So there is a truth in the matter that there's problems with wheat, how it's being processed. There's problems with the genetically modification and the environmental aspects we're actually been exposed to. But the problem is this. It's not the actual grain itself. We've been eating grains for thousands and thousands of years in all cultures. So we kind of easily pick this. And, you know, a lot of these books are now are picking on the wheat, but really they're kind of going back to what we remember in about 20 years ago, the Atkins diet, really. And what they're looking at is just going to what I have a problem with and what the data will also have a problem with is what they're recommending to replace with that. So the concept of, you know, the paleo diet, and I know I'm going to get tons of emails after this, but the paleo diet and, you know, animal protein diets and, you know, and kind of that caveman diet, you know, in my book we'll go through all the detail of why and how that is, as it has proven wrong over the last 20 years since the Atkins diet, not the most beneficial aspect. And so there's a little bit of a misnomer. Now, what is true about people first trying any of those diets is that, you know, they lose weight. And the reason why they lose weight is because they're not eating the highly refined carbohydrate. That doesn't mean that all carbohydrates are bad. So you still need to have organic whole grains, absolutely. But again, if people stop eating donuts and big old Subway sandwiches, will they lose weight? Absolutely, 100%. I tell all my patients, if you stop eating donuts, you'll lose weight. that's a truth of the matter of fact.
Uh-huh.
The problem is, you know, what we replace with that is people then say, well, I just want to eat animal proteins and I just want to be like the Paleolithic man. And in my book, I'll actually go through the historical use and the historical data now that actually showed that the Paleolithic man was actually eating grains at the time as well. Okay, and when they did eat animal protein, they weren't eating it every day. It was actually more grass-fed than corn-fed. It's actually very small amounts, and they didn't have, you know, for example, a Paleolithic man would maybe have a wild boar. They would cook it on a fire, and they would feed it with the rest of their tribe. Here, what happens is we drive in our car, and through our window, we get a Baconator, for example, right? And the problem is that we have not expended any energy, time, or effort. In the Paleolithic time, they would have to hunt for that animal. They'd have to go, like even the Maasai in Africa, who are the closest people right now we know historically, who still kind of eat truly paleo in a way. But they go like 20 to 30 miles a day,
mm-hmm.
right? And they're tall, thin people, you know?
Yeah.
And they also eat other parts of the animal that they don't eat. They drink the blood, they eat all these other organs. And so, yes, I mean, I say if you're like the Maasai, great. But, you know, driving in your car and your truck and picking up breakfast, lunch, and dinner, we've not done anything. And also that food itself in my book, I will show the data very clearly how even the food has changed. Our sustainable agriculture has now gone to factory farming, and so the food has become more inflammatory. So food that's grass-fed and organic, for example, eggs and beef, has a 3-to-1 ratio of inflammation, 4-to-1 ratio of inflammation of beef, 3-to-1 with eggs. But when it's corn-fed, it's a 20-to-1 and a 24-to-1 for eggs and beef, respectively. So what we now know is that most food is factory farmed, so we're eating 7 times more inflammation in the food itself. It doesn't mean that we're eating more, even though most people are today.
Uh-huh.
But it's the food itself has changed because the animal itself is not eating what it's supposed to, right? So we don't have the cow on the field anymore. We have the cow in a trough.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have people in restaurants that have corral in the name. We have to look at this whole concept of what are we doing and what are we feeding not only the animals, what are we feeding ourselves? And at the end of the day, you are what you eat. That statement has come true.
Uh-huh. And what about gluten?
So with gluten, so there is a certain amount of people that actually have gluten sensitivities. And so in our office, we actually test for that. We actually test for not only the gluten, we also test for the gliadin. We also test for the kind of celiac antibodies as well. It's a spectrum. So where we fell short, Emmett, I think you mm-hmm. and I in our conventional training, is that we used to do some testing for celiac disease, and it was either positive or not.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was negative, we said, okay, go ahead and eat all the wheat. You don't have that problem. The problem is that test was only positive if there was antibodies developed in our colon from the chronic exposure to these gluten aspects and gluten proteins. Now we understand that there's a spectrum. And most people, by the time they actually end up having pathology in the colon by a diagnostic biopsy, okay, is that they've had inflammation for decades. And so now we can look at the gluten and gliadin. There's certain tests that we do that look for IgA, IgG of these gluten and gliadin factors. That will tell us, is this person having inflammation in the gut? It's just not broken yet. And if we see that's positive, then definitely they have to go gluten-free and they get better. But the biggest question is, why is everybody having a gluten problem?
Yeah.
So it's just more than just the gluten itself. Is that we don't see these numbers in Europe. We don't see these numbers in countries that don't use these glyphosates, and they don't genetically modify, and they don't highly process. They actually cook it. So
uh-huh.
if we went to France, we would see less of that because they actually bake the bread and they ferment it all day long. They use multi yeast cultures, for example. Here I can go across the street to a grocery store. At 3 o'clock they use a monostart one culture, and by 5 o'clock French bread is baked.
Uh-huh.
So there's a lot of differences in why our country is that way, but we always test if someone does have a gluten problem, definitely go away. And in fact, right now we have 6 patients which we're glad to talk about that had actually celiac disease by biopsy positive and also blood test positive. And within 12 months to 16 months, around 16 months usually it takes people to change their diets, if they go 100% gluten-free, we give them the bosmeric SL, which are anti-inflammatory. We give them probiotics. We make sure that the vitamin D levels in their immune system are up, that they can actually reverse. They actually reverse, meaning that those antibodies, not only in the blood test, but when they actually do the biopsy in the colon, is negative.
Mm-hmm.
So we can actually reverse pathology. The problem is, by the time we conventionally used to check and find these people, they were so down the line that they didn't know what to do. And then we never gave them anything that could support their body's innate ability to heal itself.
What percent of people out there in the general population do you think have some gluten sensitivity?
I think there's a lot. In our practice, I probably see a handful a week.
Uh-huh, wow.
Now, I'll give you an example. When I was in medical school, so I'm much, much younger than you are. But so say 20 years ago.
Wait a minute.
So just when you were like rocking and rolling in practice, I was starting this thing. But, what I learned in medical school in the early 90s was the rate at that time of celiac disease was 1 in 100,000.
Right.
And I was told that if you saw one, it'd be rare. And if you saw two, it'd be like winning the lottery. It would
right.
be almost impossible to see. And now it's 1 in 100. Okay, and then remember, if you look at it, the genes have been changed in 20 years of people. It's the, it's the epigenetics, it's the environment, it's the toxins, mm-hmm. it's all these things that have changed. What the food has changed, not the people. And how we process it, that's what's changed. And so we actually have to look at, I see a lot more gluten-sensitive people. I still see, probably every month maybe 1 or 2 celiac disease patients, which is phenomenal because, again, it used to be rare to see in your entire history of practice. of medicine. And I have a whole closet, you know, drawer full of celiac, but there's more gluten patients. But a lot of people jump on the gluten bandwagon thinking like, oh, it's a fad, it's a weight loss thing. And so we're losing, though, if you don't have a sensitivity to gluten, you're losing a lot of nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the grains have a lot of B vitamins, they have fiber, they also have protein. And remember, there's other grains inside of wheat. So a lot of people freak out when they say, oh my God, I can't have wheat. I mean, there's spelt, there's millet, there's quinoa, there's buckwheat. I mean, there's tons of other grains. There's even rice, for example. And everybody's afraid of some of these other grains. Like, oh my God, rice will make me gain weight. But 90% of the world eats rice like 3 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have the obesity that we do.
Yeah.
Right? So it's funny how we kind of pick on certain foods, and we have to stand back and look at, well, in my book, I'm going to look at the data of outcomes. And right now, the U.S. ranks 46 out of 48 industrial nations in terms of health outcomes from A to Z. So from Alzheimer's to asthma to cancer, diabetes, obesity, you name it, depression, you name all the conditions, we're 46 out of 48 industrial nations. So there's 45 other countries that do better than us, and we spent $1.3 trillion last year in healthcare. So there's a mismatch. What we're really good at is acute care, you know, gunshot wounds, we need to do surgery, we get in an accident or trauma, we're the world's best. And we have a great, for example, a trauma center here in New Mexico. It's phenomenal, right?
Mm-hmm.
For the chronic disease that you and I see on a daily basis as a family physician, they're chronic. And they've been disease managed, but they haven't been disease resolved. And that's the kind of our approach that we take, is we have to look at the underlying triggering mechanisms and restore those functions and let the body's innate ability to heal itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I seem to pick up a suggestion from some of the things that you said that you're not a fan of Roundup.
Absolutely not. I probably will get some kind of court order tomorrow. Now that we've had this discussion, then I'll probably have some kind of limitation on my speech tomorrow. So I'm not a fan of it, yes. That's true. So most of America, unfortunately, you know, I'll just give the example where how bad it is. Just recently, my lifestyle director Maureen, who's in my practice here, she does all the yoga. She used to work with Deepak Chopra, and we do all the Ayurvedic medicine and the Panchakarma detoxification and the nutrition and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Her brothers live in Hawaii, and Maui, you know, just got overruling the second time. They banned GMOs. They wanted to ban GMOs from Maui, and now Monsanto pressured again, and now the federal judge has now said that they're overriding the county's rule.
Mm.
So there's it's a big turf war, because we really want people to know, you know, just as much as people want to know where your iPhone is made and where your tennis shoes are made and what's the situation, you want to know where your fruits and vegetables and your cows and your pigs and chickens also have been. That all plays an important part of sustainability and environmental and with labor and everything else like that.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I do want to touch upon is that once we do have inflammation, how do we reduce that?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I've been working over in the last 15 years and in the last 6 years, we've come up with something called Bosmeric SR.
Yes.
And that's kind of been our flagship of what do we do to help reduce inflammation now that our people are transitioning their diets, or they actually have an active inflammatory disease, like anything that has the word itis in it. And instead of taking an ibuprofen, Motrin, or Advil, which all have black box warnings, and black box warnings means that you can have a GI bleed, stomach, intestine perforation at any time without any warning symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
You can also have a heart attack or stroke, even if you have normal lipid parameters. This happens every day more often than not. That's why it's a black box warning. The black box warning means that you can basically end up in the black box.
Uh-huh.
I actually show that in the conference. I think you saw that. I showed a little black box coffin, and that's where people can end up in. So people ask, well, if it's so dangerous, why do we still allow it? Because once that black box has been put on the product, which all of them have, ibuprofen, Motrin, Aleve, and Advil, and Celebrex, and all the stuff. They even mention it on the commercial. It's even on the insert. But once they open up that package, they've accepted the terms and conditions herein that those incidences can happen. And so there's no legal liability. So if you go to any kind of pharmacy store, you can see from one aisle to the other aisle every generic profen that you can. And you can even yourself can open up a factory as long as you're, you know, regulated and do everything for good manufacturing practices and make a product that one-third of the population takes every day. Now, earlier I mentioned that heart disease was number two common cause of death in the United States. Number three is cancer. Number four is stroke. But the data will show, and Gary Null did a nice review with a couple of other physicians and researchers, and they showed the data showing that the number one cause of death as of 2012, 2011 was adverse drug reactions and medical errors. So actually our own medicine that we're trying to use with people commonly is actually causing more fatalities than heart disease and stroke and cancer. And so this is what led me to define and develop something called Bosmeric.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Bosmeric is an anti-inflammatory product. It contains 4 patented ingredients at clinical doses. It contains something called curcumin, which everybody's familiar with, but we use the patented form of curcumin C3 complex, which has 65 human clinical trials on that. And what kind of created the gold standard? That company's actually provided the monograph, so we know more about curcumin than anybody, even though everybody at the conferences will say, oh, there's a newer form, better observable. That will be all detailed in my book of how those are different and why a lot of people are getting misled.
Uh-huh.
Aside of the curcumin, we have something called Boswellia PS. Boswellia is frankincense. So many people know from a biblical standpoint, you know, frankincense, myrrh, and gold. And myrrh is actually Google. It's an Ayurvedic herb that we use for cholesterol and inflammation. And Boswellia is frankincense. And now we're looking at the gold as actually being referenced to be turmeric. Because turmeric at that time actually was treated more heavily and was more expensive than gold during the spice trade at that time.
Uh-huh.
So we can see some historical reference. Ginger, we use ginger at a 20% ginger oil extract, and the Bioprene, which is a black pepper standardized extract that's been patented to help enhance the absorption. All 4 of these ingredients, not only by themselves, but more better together, they have a synergistic effect. And that means it's not 1 + 1 = 2, it's a 1 + 1 = 3. It has a 20-minute onset of action, and it's an 8-hour sustained release. It's in a bilayered sustained release caplet. And so we were the first company to actually manufacture something to have that immediate water-soluble and the lipid-soluble action together. So they can take it just like a fast-tab ibuprofen or Tylenol, bam, within 20 minutes, a headache, knee, back pain, that will go down, but then it lasts over 8 hours. And so what I've done is taken kind of the ancient wisdom of Ayurvedic medicine, which is the traditional medicine of India, which is, they use these 4 things commonly, and kind of pharmaceutically look at how can we give it so that people can take something conveniently. Because Americans, we want things fast, we want things now, and we don't want to take it that often.
Wow. That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that we remove people from taking, you know, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories over the counter. We replace it with something like Bosmeric, but then we look at everything else. We want to look at your diet, what's triggering inflammation, stress reduction like you do,
sure.
For example. So we know that stress causes increases of inflammation. We actually have studies that say that it increases, and we can actually state like NF-kappa-beta. All the different kind of inflammatory switches in the body are turned on with stress. So stress reduction is super important. We do yoga. We even have flotation therapy here in our facility. So we have a float tank, which is great. People float in 1,200 pounds of Epsom salt for an hour. 1 hour in the tank is equivalent to 6 hours of deep sleep, and the effects last for 3 to 5 days of increasing their intracellular magnesium levels just via absorption in the skin. So there's different ways that we can look at lowering inflammation. Some of it's just relaxation. Some of it's yoga, as you do, like meditation and guided imagery. We highly support and recommend all our patients do that. But first, when they come in and someone's in the flare, and they usually have some kind of chronic pain or aggravating condition,
mm-hmm.
when we give them the Bosmeric, you know, they need to have that first quick fix experience. Just like when people probably come in, you probably give them a small little session, and they go, wow, I feel so much relaxed.
Right.
They need to have that. Otherwise, they're like, well, why am I investing my time to spend 20 minutes a day doing this little listening to this tape? But once they listen to the tape, they're like, oh, my God, how much better do I feel?
Uh-huh.
Same thing. Once they take the Bosmeric, it's kind of this transformating experience. And we have now over about 4,000 clients of ours who take this on a daily basis. And we have multiple clinics now around the United States that are providing this to their patients.
What about folks who are taking a little aspirin every day to prevent cardiovascular problems?
Okay. So aspirin's a very interesting thing because the new cardiology guidelines actually remove the daily aspirin or the baby aspirin in the regimen because more people now die of a GI bleed than the prevention of the heart attack,
mm-hmm.
baby aspirin. Now, baby aspirin lasts 7 to 10 days pharmacologically in the platelet inhibition. Right?
Uh-huh.
So, and also, most people take a non-enteric coated, but we want them to take an enteric coated aspirin. So, with patients that are seen by cardiology that have had a previous history of heart disease or heart attack, then what we like to do is we like to balance the data. So, the data will show, well, if it lasts 7 to 10 days, and we know that it has that effect, how can we minimize the risk of a GI bleed,
mm-hmm.
but also get the potentiating antiplatelet benefit? So, now what we look at with our patients, if they've already been seen by a cardiologist and they're recommended, okay, you need to take an aspirin. But remember, the cardiologist takes care of the heart. They don't take care of the GI bleed that happens,
right?
Like that always happens, right? They turf them to other people.
Yeah.
So what happens is what we do is then we say with our patients, take an 81 milligram enteric coated with food. But what if you took it every 4 days? Mm-hmm. Every 5 days. Don't pass the 7 days. So you're still getting that benefit, but you're also lowering that side effect potential. Now, certain companies who make aspirin, I won't name them, but certain aspirin companies will say you should take it every day. But that's because they want you to buy a pill every day so they sell more pills.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have to look at it from a pharmacological standpoint and a safety standpoint. It's like, how can we get a benefit of something that's very cheap and effective, but also not make it so effective that you also have a GI bleed?
Uh-huh.
So that's how we look at the baby aspirin. But here's the interesting thing. Why are people taking baby aspirin? It's because the baby aspirin decreases platelet inhibition. What causes the platelets to become sticky? Sympathetic response, which is stress, which is everything that you talk about and how to reduce. Okay, and inflammation due to stress. So when people are in the sympathetic fight or flight response, actually that's when the platelets become the stickiest. Right?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
When we're in the fight or flight, we have increased heart rate, we have increased blood flow, blood goes to our chest, right? Blood goes to the extremities because we're going to fight, we're going to run. But one of the things that also occurs that people forget, this is number 10 on the list of sympathetic response. We only learn the top 3 or 4 in medical school because that's what they usually test for.
Mm-hmm.
But way lower, if we go back in the book, it'll say that the platelets get a little bit sticky. Here's the interesting thing is because if you're in a fight or flight, not only does the heart rate go up and blood transfer to the extremities, etc., but why the platelets get sticky is because it's anticipating damage,
right.
Okay, or trauma. Just like your cortisol goes up because it's like saying, okay, if I get bitten or stabbed, I need to have my own prednisone, my own steroid to lower the inflammation, and I need to have the platelets get a little sticky so I won't bleed out. I can clot fast. The problem is we're not getting attacked or bitten, but
right.
We open up our mortgage debt, we have credit card debt, we're getting stressed, we got kids in school, we got all traffic jams, and so people are getting very upset. That is stuff. Just opening a letter of bad news can cause someone to have a heart attack.
Right. That's why so many heart attacks, the day of the week where all the heart attacks occur, the maximum number is on Monday morning.
Monday morning. But we also know people, for example, like, you know, we have a lot of cases where people, like a son or daughter has been injured or they have tragically passed away in Iraq or Afghanistan, and they get that letter, bam, they get a heart attack.
Yeah.
No heart disease. That just causes that sympathetic reaction, right? Or shoveling snow. It's just that stress of the body is doing this. They don't have to be exercising. It's just the stress itself can cause it. So there's a reason why we give the aspirin. The question we still have to say, even though it's maybe
mm-hmm.
cheap and effective,
sure.
if we give it correctly, why are we still giving aspirin?
Sure.
Right. So I always want to go one step further. Even when we have natural therapy. So even when people come to me and say, okay, I've taken all these things and I'm getting better. And then I say, guess what we're going to do? We're going to slowly start changing these things, and we're going to start weaning these things off. Because the idea is that we want to take these natural therapies to create a balance when there's an imbalance, but you also don't want to be taking tons and tons of supplements either. Right? Our goal is to keep the body in balance. The body and mind needs to be balanced by itself through diet and lifestyle. Supplements only supplement the body. They don't replace food. You don't just take them for any reason. We have to give people specifics. So we even do nutrition testing with our patients. So if they're wondering, like, do I need to take supplements? Yes, you can. We can test all the vitamins and minerals and CoQ10 and alpha lipoic acid levels and glutathione levels and heavy metals. We can do all that. Now, most of the insurance companies are covering these kinds of tests because we need to know nutrition is super
mm-hmm.
important.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we give things that are very targeted in our practice, and we always give things that are patented. We have clinical studies, and our products are always third-party tested. So just like you want to certify, you know, here's something that you want people to watch or read, when we give supplements in our practice and natural therapies, and I'm removing or reducing a medicine, I need to have the evidence to back it up, but that's why it works. And that's why our pharmacy here in-house is very specific. We don't have everything because what we use here is what we want to use specifically. Like with our Bosmeric, it's very specific. But the nice thing is that anybody can use it, and it has a multitude of benefits.
Mm, wow. Well, now, last couple of minutes, I want you to talk about love.
Love it. All you need is it. That's what John Lennon said.
Yeah, he's right.
Right? Unfortunately, John Lennon was shot. So, and right now, I think right in the country right now, we're in a dichotomy. You know, right now, we had a wonderful week, right? We had this wonderful gay marriage thing, and people are going to have that opportunity to actually now formally express love, whatever their definition may be, in public. I think that's a great thing. But also, you can see that 50% of the country or half the country is also very upset at that, which is disturbing to me. Right, and I think love is very important. I think a lot of people, particularly in the Western culture, do not experience love on all the different parameters. And I think that's what I see in a lot of patients that have anxiety, depression, a lot of abuse, a lot of sexual abuse, a lot of physical trauma, is that we lack that simple thing called love. And, you know, if there was a pill that had love in it, then we'd probably be billionaires. Because everybody needs some. And I think they need to find that love. But I think the love first starts coming from within. So we always like to teach people about self and spirit, how to love themselves, because a lot of people have religious dogma or have guilt. And we want to remove all that when they come to my clinic. I say, you know, people have, you know, say I have a lot of Catholic patients. Say if they have cancer, now they have cancer, and then they have guilt on top of that. Mm-hmm. We need to kind of remove that dogma and say, look, we need to look at what's going to be good for you, what's going to be good for your family, what's going to be good for your community, and build that love from within. I think that's so important. And I think it's lacking because we put stereotypes, we put definitions, and how people experience what love is. I mean, there's even a commercial I saw the other day by a chemical company saying, you know, love is a chemical process, you know? And I'm like, this is what they're trying to get, is that everything is a pharmaceutical derivative of something that you take, and that's what love is. And love is kind of amorphous. We can't put it in a bottle. We can't, you know, every culture, every person may experience it differently. And I think it's very important, but I would never, I mean, that's why it was the last step in my book, because how do we round off everything is that sometimes all people need is love. And if they have that, mm-hmm. then everything gets better.
Yeah.
If they don't, you can take the best food, the best supplements, and still get cancer.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's important. And I think with my patients who have done the best, even who've overcome the worst odds, is because they have that. They have the self-love, and they have love of their plan. They have love of their neighbor. And it's not just saying, you know, turn the cheek and be passive, for example. Some of these people are very activists and active in their community. But the idea is that it's moving past, it's kind of elevating their consciousness. And I think that's the best thing, that, you know, doing guided imagery, meditation, even prayer, for example, is important. So whatever the person does, you know, one of the things that people know is that we're part of the Aklava Native American Church. And so what that allows us in our practice is to actually formally protect and formally prescribe and recommend indigenous therapies, Ayurvedic medicine, Chinese medicine, Native American medicine. But that includes spirit. So it's not just doing the body and mind, it's including the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Aklava means, the word actually means an unstoppable river that flows in and around.
Ooh.
And so that's kind of what we are. You know, Sanjeevani means, in Sanskrit, is the rejuvenation, or the herb which brings back life. So we're always looking at, well, it should be like flowing like the river, and we should always be rejuvenating ourselves. And that's what we do here in our practice. And I think, you know, love and what you do is important. I think many people don't give enough credit to mind-body medicine because we're so stuck in the body.
Yeah.
But I also think now what we're trying to do in our clinic is not only take the mind and the body, but now we're trying to include the spirit as well.
That's wonderful. Well, we sure burned up that hour really quickly. Thank you so much, Sunil.
Oh, thank you very much.
I love it. And I'll want to remind everyone that they can learn more about you and about your very special clinic. Gee, I wish I lived in New Mexico. But when your book comes out, Inflammation and Inflammation Nation, I think we'll all be able to start using some of your some of the things that you've learned and some of the wisdom that that you have to share.
Absolutely, and I hope I can return back on the show when the book comes out and we can go further in detail.
Be great. And so you go now to www.Sanjeevani, that's S as in Sam, A, N as in Nancy, J, E, V as in Victory, A, N as in Nancy, I, Sanjeevani.net, and learn more about Dr. Pai. And it's been wonderful having you all here with us. And if you have any questions or comments or contributions you'd like to share with us, please do. Please join our ongoing conversation at facebook.com/AskDrMiller or email me at drmiller@drmiller.com. So until we meet again, remember, stay tuned.
You've been listening to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People, on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. For more information about Dr. Miller's work, upcoming events, new programs, and how you can change your mind and change your life, visit his multimedia website at drmiller.com. That's drmiller.com. Conversations with Extraordinary People is produced in the drmiller.com studios. Special thanks to Jesse Churchill and Deborah Beauvais.